Hi, my name is Paul Sloan. Welcome to another episode of Think About It. I'm talking today with Dr. Ben Blackwell, the professor of New Testament and Early Christianity here at Houston Christian University, and also director of our Houston Theological Seminary, and writing a forthcoming book. It's about to come out with Urbans.
Yes.
That's right. Topic is on justification. The title is Participating in the Righteousness of God. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's I came across this topic of the relationship between justification and life. And so that's the subtitle there. And so exploring that intersection of ideas and, as you said, getting into the weeds of 2,000 years of church history and biblical theology.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is like I was talking with somebody the other day about a Pauline topic, and I said, oh, XYZ is, you know, understudied. And he laughed, and he goes, there's no understudied topic in Paul. I think I was talking about, you know, purity or something. He said, there's no understudied topic in Paul. You know, much less justification. What makes you, you know, feel like there's a room for another statement on this issue?
Yeah, that when I stumbled across this in a lot of ways, I never intended to become a justification or get in these battles. Back about 10 years ago, I wrote an article about the idea of glory in Romans. And so this my basic argument is that every time you see glory in Romans show up, or just about every time, the idea of immortality is right there with it. And so just the sense of setting glory in the context of this historical framework, so not just in Paul's own argument, but then within the whole scope of Second Temple Judaism. And so this idea of glory is participating in God's immortal presence, and so that we become immortal like him. And in the midst of that, so Romans 3:23, we all have sinned and lack the glory of God, was central to that. And so making the argument that sin leads to death, so by when we lack God's immortal glory, then we become mortal. Therefore, we experience death. And very much like you see in Romans 5:12, that we all sinned and therefore we all died. Right. But the interesting thing about all this is that 3:23 is not a complete sentence on its own. Mm-hmm. It's followed by 3:24 that we all have sinned, lack the glory of God, and yet we're being justified freely by his grace. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, justification is a response to this problem of mortality and death. And that just didn't fit with any of the categories that I'd ever worked in. I grew up evangelical, and so what we know is the kind of traditional reformational perspective that justification means forgiveness. As a status declaration, as my starting point, I knew that other wider debates were out there. I'd worked for N.T. Wright for a couple of years, and so began to wade into the new perspective, but neither one of those really got into the weeds or really made sense of what was going on here. And so, as with a lot of things, you just start pulling the thread and you know, captured a wider vision of what's going on in Romans and then Paul's theology more general.
Yeah, so if I heard you right, it's you are associating, or you saw an association between glory and life, or lack of glory and death. Mm-hmm. And then particularly within Romans 3 and maybe other passages we can talk about, you saw that particular plight or that particular problem, the mortality or death or lack of glory, is then solved, at least terminologically, right, with justification language, right? So I guess the 3:24, we've all sinned and are lacking glory and are dying, but now we're justified, etc. So justification meeting that particular issue. Is that right?
So it's the solution to the problem of death, right? In that sense. So the initial presupposition then is that justification has something to do with the idea of life and therefore even participation in God's life. And so that was the thread that I started to pull and, you know, just kept going down this train of even, you know, you go back to the initial parts of Romans 1 that, you know, that Paul's gospel is about the righteousness of God being revealed through faith and to faith. But then this statement in Habakkuk 2:4 that he uses, the righteous by faith will live. And so that you see this initial in the thesis of the letter itself that justification, those who become righteous by faith will live, that there's this actual promise there of this life. And so that 3:23 and 24 actually fits within that wider theme of the whole letter.
Okay, that's helpful. So, and you said you pulled this thread and it kind of just kept expanding. Maybe before we get to other Pauline texts on it, because you're focusing on Paul, right?
Yeah.
Mostly Pauline issue, right?
Yep. So
focusing, before we get to maybe other Pauline texts, I wonder if you could unpack the like maybe broader biblical texts, whether it's, you know, covenantal stuff from the Old Testament or Genesis 1 through 3 stuff, or where else do you see this sort of, you know, foundation operative that Paul is playing with? And
yeah, that is an important aspect that as I've drawn this out of where justification is primarily a legal metaphor, right? About a judge doing thing to judge positively, and condemnation then for Paul would be the negative. In a lot of ways, actually, Paul's use of this language is unique, or at least the Christian language is unique in his Greco-Roman context. So let me give you an example. With adoption, we don't see adoption showing up in the Septuagint or Old Testament text. It's purely a Greco-Roman idea then. And so people ask about the idea of levirate marriage and other things as a way to make sense of that. But it's you don't have this idea that of adoption that you get, say, with the Roman emperors and that kind of thing. Whereas with justification, the word dikaio in Greek is always in the Greco-Roman context actually associated with condemnation, the negative judgment.
Oh, interesting.
And so that means then that when Paul is using it only in a positive fashion, that he's doing something unique, and actually he's following the Septuagint and other Greek Jewish texts that use it positively. And so that tells us then that we should go back to the Old Testament and the Septuagint to find its core meaning.
Okay.
And as a positive statement. And so you find the language then comes out of legal context where you have judges, normal everyday judges, like we would have court judges, but then also God as judge. And so it's out of these theological contexts of God as judge. And primarily it's the covenant lawsuit then, I think, is the primary angle or foundation for what Paul is talking about here, is that God, through the prophets, is often executing this covenant lawsuit, and so that the covenant stipulations of blessing and cursing are at the core of what justification is about. Okay. So that if you are justified, then you would experience the covenant blessings. And so there are two different structures. We get a little bit further in the weeds.
Okay.
A guy named James Prothrow has a Moore Zebeck volume on these two different legal structures.
Okay.
And I think Paul uses both of those.
Okay.
But, basically, they come back to this idea of covenant blessing. And,
okay.
And so in that sense, then, if you think about how covenant curses and blessings work, you go to Deuteronomy 30, right? It's a great summary of this. And what does Moses say? I set before you today blessing and cursing, but also life and death.
Mm-hmm.
So choose life. And so participating in the covenant blessings, life then, you know, to use the literary term as a metonymy, it's a part that signifies the whole.
Gotcha.
So if you experience life, then you're experiencing all the covenant blessings.
Gotcha.
And so in that sense, then, as we're justification points to this restored relationship with God, right? This the covenant curses were there before.
Yep.
We have restoration now through Christ as the mediator for this new covenant, that we're experiencing life as a signal of the wider covenant restoration.
Okay, so that's helpful. So you're thinking in terms of sort of the well, one of the larger frameworks is the covenant itself, particularly the as encoded in, you know, Deuteronomy and Leviticus. And because the covenant itself is a legal agreement, that is kind of the semantic domain or kind of cultural domain within which legal language gets used to describe the covenantal blessings and curses. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's right. And so, of course, it transforms a little bit from the prophets, where this is within Second Temple Judaism. It moves away from the covenant lawsuit against the people as a whole so much that it moves to this idea of God's judgment off into the future, and it tends to be more individualized, right? So then you have this, where are you going to stand before God at the final judgment?
Okay.
And is he going to justify you, recognize you as righteous, and therefore to participate in these covenant blessings? Or is that something you're going to be condemned before God?
Okay.
And so it has this eschatological vision. And of course, Paul then, in light of the Christ event, has transformed history before him, I guess, in that sense.
Okay.
And so that if we participate in Christ, that final judgment is brought forward to the point of conversion where we encounter Christ. And so that we we now experience this positive judgment that was going to happen in the eschaton at the final judgment is now moved forward to the present.
Okay. So there's a few things there we could probably unpack. You talked a lot about there about sort of a union with Christ or participating in Christ. You didn't say union, but participating in Christ, mm-hmm. that sort mm-hmm. of thing. And also you talked about the future judgment in pretty sort of judicial terms, or standing before God in sort of a judicial context. I wonder, this might then, as to kind of bridge to the next segment where we can maybe go further into your view. Some of that stuff will sound familiar to our listeners. You know, if they hear union or participation, they're going to think, you know, reformers have said X, Y, Z, or, mm-hmm. you know, in a judicial context for the judgment, that sounds very familiar from lots of, you know, biblical context and, you know, and contemporary interpreters. So how would you position your view in contradistinction to, or even in context of other contemporary takes on this?
Yeah. So far I've only kind of mentioned justification as a positive judicial judgment. And so in that sense, it would be the same as the other major contemporary views on this. What my specific argument is then is that justification, when Paul uses this language, is that justification is being made alive as a part of this covenant blessing experience. Now, not everybody is as happy with using the language of covenant as a way to articulate justification. And so some do this and some don't. And so if we go back to, say, the traditional reformational perspective, that justification is a status declaration that you're right before God. And so in that sense, some will see that as a covenantal issue. Those tend to be more reformed or in the Calvinistic tradition, and then the Lutherans tend to see it more as a creational argument. But either way, it's set justification as a status declaration. So it is a positive judgment. It's just the verdict. It's not the execution of that verdict.
Okay.
And so I would say it is both the verdict and its execution. But in that status declaration, the primary idea that's communicated in the reformational perspective is that justification means forgiveness.
Okay. Like
you're forgiven before God. So we were sinful, and as he justifies us, he's forgiving us. We're declared not guilty. And so that would be the starting point for contemporary New Testament scholarship. And then you have the new perspective, which would be a decidedly covenantal reading of Paul. And instead of it being declared not guilty by the judge, they see justification much more as God separating out between the opposing nations and his people. Mm-hmm. And so when God justifies them, he's defining those who are in right relationship with him, that his people over against the nations. And so in that sense, instead of forgiveness as the primary referent, it's covenant membership would be what justification entails. Or if you want a more direct term, adoption actually is that in the same way that adoption, it's a legal process that you're declared part of my people instead of not my people. And so that would be the new perspective on Paul.
Okay.
And then the third avenue out there is the rectification or the apocalyptic approach to justification. And so this is influenced by wider kind of theological movements from going back to Adolf Schlatter and Ernst Casemann, and has a different iteration with the disciples of Lou Martin. But in this sense, the problem is not so much that you're status before God, but in the same way the new perspective has these opposing nations and that we're part of God's people, what the apocalyptic group says is that it's not the nations out there that are the opposition, it's these evil powers.
Okay.
And so that when God justifies his people, he is saving them and separating them from these evil powers. And so instead of forgiveness or adoption, this group has liberation as the primary referent.
Gotcha.
And so in some ways, this is actually where, when I started pulling this thread, this was when Douglas Campbell's Deliverance of God tome on Paul and particularly Romans came out. And that was where I finally, I think, was introduced to this perspective more fully. And so death is one of these major powers that Campbell would say is that we're delivered from. And so that cohered in a way with where I was going. But at the same time, there's some limitations to what I would say Campbell is doing.
Okay.
And so the mode that, or perspective that I'm following would be called the participationist
okay.
model.
Yet a
so,
fourth model.
A fourth
right.
one. and so yep. this is the, in a way, the all of the above, at least in this sense. And part of this has to do with the nature of these legal contentions that mm-hmm. come out of the Old mm-hmm. Testament. That the reformational perspective is right, that this standing just before us and God is one of the key models mm-hmm. in the Old Testament. And so forgiveness is essential as one of these covenant blessings. But then also being saved from the foreign nations, mm-hmm. these foreign mm-hmm. powers. And rather than the Gentiles, the nations being the opposition. Mm-hmm. And so this is why I think the new perspective doesn't work as effectively, is because Paul doesn't set the nations against mm-hmm. his people. Mm-hmm. in that way, but it's so the apocalyptic vision of the nations, these foreign powers being transformed into these evil powers that mm-hmm. stand against us, and mm-hmm. so that both of these models are evident in the Old Testament, mm-hmm. and they're not seen as an opposition, and so that Paul right. then is using both of those models as he's constructing his view of justification. And so whether the covenant curse is that you're just disobedient and you die, seems pretty obvious in the Old Testament, or the covenant curse is these nations come and invade your space and kill you, mm-hmm. The response to that, the solution to that, is being restored to relationship with God and in that experiencing life. And so that Paul then is doing, so being made alive then isn't in opposition, or this participation is not in opposition to or mutually exclusive from these other positions, but actually drawing the strengths of both of them.
Okay, that's helpful, because what you're saying is, because it's a covenantal reality, it facilitates the use of the legal language, and the legal, but what the legal language is pointing to is the restored relationship between the sinner and God, or whether on the individual level or the corporate level, whatever at the yep. moment. But you seem to be kind of more accentuating the individual, but that restoration toward God brings all these benefits, covenant blessings, I guess you'd say, mm-hmm. Organically with them, or something like that, right?
Yep.
And that includes forgiveness and everything else, but also eschatological life, right?
Yes.
Immortality, that sort of thing. Is that right? Or
I think that's right. The interesting thing, and so again, like I don't in any way want to be seen as discounting the reformational model,
sure.
but there is one key flaw to this model
okay.
to highlight or foreground forgiveness as the essential kind of restoration yep. aspect of this. Not that forgiveness is not something that happens with faith in Jesus or in the Gospels, or that forgiveness is absent in Paul. What's absent is the intersection of forgiveness and justification language, at
okay.
least directly. So you only have one explicit link between forgiveness and justification in Paul's letters, and that's in Romans 4. Mm-hmm. And it's obvious, right? I mean, it's undeniable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you have other language that would, instead of explicit connection, they're implicit language.
Mm-hmm.
So like in Romans 3, you have the hilasterion language,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? And so
yep.
that this would historically imply forgiveness.
Right.
With atonement and things like this,
yep.
but it's, you know, Paul doesn't go out of his way to explicitly link
spell
these.
That out, yeah.
Whereas what I would say is almost every passage that he talks about justification explicitly draws in the language of life
mm-hmm.
or glory or
okay.
immortality or things like this that foreground. So it's not that forgiveness isn't there, but forgiveness is backgrounded and life is foregrounded.
Okay. So let's jump into one of those passages. And what passage do you think probably best exemplifies that?
Yeah, the maybe an easy one to start with would be Romans 8, 1 and 2.
Okay.
And so this actually doesn't use the language of justification, but I think it gets to maybe a simple way that we see this is that we see there is therefore now no condemnation.
Mm-hmm.
And so latotes, I guess, is the
yep, yep.
the language there. When you say not something, you're describing the opposite.
The positive one, yeah.
So if there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ, we know that since condemnation is the antonym, that
mm-hmm.
there is justification
yeah,
for those
yeah.
who are in Christ.
Yep.
But what does it look like for this justification to happen? For the law of the Spirit of life has set you free from the law of sin and death. And so in this sense, that what he's highlighting here is that through the agency of the Spirit in this new covenant text, that the Spirit's restoration of the people of God through the Messiah then is that they're freed from death and given life. And so but what I would say is that's a climax of an argument that starts in 1:16 and 17.
Okay.
Right. I think that Paul often signals what he's doing in the text by use of Old Testament text.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so importantly in Romans 1, he says that there he's early in Romans 1, right? Verse 2, 3 is that he's preaching this. He was set apart for this gospel of God, which was promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. And the gospel is concerning his son, who descended from David according to the flesh and was declared son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by resurrection from the dead. So his gospel is centered in the death and resurrection of Jesus as the Messiah. But importantly, he says it was promised beforehand through the prophets. And so the first major quotation of the prophet shows up in Habakkuk 2:4 in his thesis statement, right? So then he comes back, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for the power of God is for salvation for everyone who has faith in that sense. It's the, and I think the power of God, this is, he's reiterating the resurrection hope, right? That is tied up in this salvation. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith or for faith, and so we can talk about the nature of faith here, and who is the faithful one. But then this is his thesis statement, the one who is righteous by faith will live.
Okay.
And so this is the gospel that was promised beforehand, and so the focus is not that a lot of times people, the translators go with the one, the righteous will live by faith,
is
that it's going to be part of the nature of their lifestyle or something, they'll be faithful people. But if you look at the rest of his letters, he never modifies faith by live there in the sense it's, but you're righteous by faith and then will live
is the promise,
out of
the
that.
Execution of the promise. Yeah. So and that puts me in mind of sort of a passage like Galatians 3:21 or something, where it's the one of the reasons there in Galatians 3 that the law is not the vehicle for righteousness is because it's not the thing that can make you alive.
Yes.
Right. So he says if a law had been given that could make alive, it's that the term that Paul typically uses for resurrection, then yeah, righteousness would be through the law. But it can't, so it's not. And he then starts to talk about, the Spirit and Christ and, of course, all that stuff being mediated through faith. So that seems like that's helpful. So that makes me then want to ask, though, we've been talking about justification and justify. So what's righteousness? Maybe that's obvious by this point in the interview, but it occurred to me we hadn't asked it yet. What's righteousness?
And I think there's an important thing here between the lexical meaning and the discourse level meaning.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, righteousness just means somebody who's right in accord with the standard. And so sometimes you'll see this with the critiques of those who see the righteousness of God as God's saving activity, which I think that is what Paul means by it. But what we have there is not just the word righteousness. We have the word righteousness, or dikaiosune, modified by the noun theou. It's the righteousness of God.
Right.
And it's that God action, or the God formation or shaping of that righteousness that helps us see, and intertextually from the Psalms and Isaiah and other things like this, that this is the action of God to bring this covenant order into place. But what we see then with righteousness itself is that you're right according to some standard.
Yep.
And so when we talk about justification as being made alive, it's not that justification at the lexical level, at the basic meaning of the word, means life or being made alive.
Yep.
Right?
Right.
It means a positive execution of a verdict.
Right.
And so that, whether that's a court and you have a human judge doing that, it's a positive execution of verdict. If God's the one who's justifying, it's a positive execution of verdict. When we get into the idea that it's God that's doing this, and in the context of that it is arising out of this final judgment, well, what happens when God justifies somebody at the final judgment? It's not so much that he's declaring them righteous at that moment, There's some good work on Romans 2:13, for instance, when you have the one who does these things will be justified. At that moment, God is not declaring them righteous. What he's doing, though, is giving them the life, the immortality, the glory at the final judgment, that they are going to be resurrected at that moment.
Gotcha.
So he's making alive those who have this positive judgment. And so in that sense, what happens in, so that's focused on the eschatological, the final judgment. What Paul is doing is because of Christ's event, we participate in Christ at conversion, and so that judgment is brought forward. And so that we're made alive in the act. And so that's not, that's a very theological, or what we'd say at the discourse level, not just what the word itself means at that.
That's helpful. Because I know we've gone around the barn on this a few times in seminar settings, but I think that's a helpful way of putting it, right? Because righteousness, I mean, just to recapitulate that righteousness doesn't sort of mean resurrection or mean give life at the lexical dictionary level. Like you wouldn't look up the word and it means make alive or whatever. But you're saying because of the larger, what would your language, discourse
model, level,
right? Because of your interpretation of that being conditioned by its sort of covenantal context, then it becomes the verdict that has this as its sort of execution, the life-giving. That's really helpful. So we've been talking a lot about justification, and it sounds like because of the resurrection language that you're also using, that's going to make people think of, you know, transformation. How do you talk about your model, your justification model, and its effects toward the actual moral or bodily transformation of someone?
That's helpful. So in a lot of ways, you know, Luther says what the doctrine on which the church stands or falls, or at least a modification of his statement there, is that the doctrine of justification is necessary. So this goes back to a fundamental Protestant versus Catholic debate, is that justification is something God does for you rather than you cooperate in, in short terms. And so the three main models, the reformational, the new perspective, and the apocalyptic model, all draw from that original Protestant fruit that justification is something that happens at conversion. It's not something that happens as a process or is codified or ratified at the final judgment because of your life lived. And so in that sense of, am I giving up my Protestant card by this more transformational reading? And actually, the person who has the most similar argument of me on this is Michael Gorman. And
he
will use the language transformation a bit more freely than I would.
Okay.
What I would say is that it's that there is an experiential reality. Mm-hmm. It's not just a status declaration, but you actually are made alive. But it's internally, it's spiritually in that sense. And that it happens at conversion.
Okay.
And so in that sense, I will hold along with the other three perspectives out there that are the major ones on the table, are all iterations of Protestant concerns in that sense, that God is the one who does that. In the same way that when Jesus is raised from the dead, he doesn't raise himself, right? It says the Father who raised him from the dead. And so
the glory of the Father.
And so in that sense that you... in that, divine agency is maintained, but instead of just a status or the verdict, it's the execution of the verdict that it happens, that we're made alive.
Okay.
And so what that does, though, then, is rather than this abstract distinction between justification as a legal reality and then you have sanctification as somehow you had to jump over this hurdle or something to link, it's not by works, but then you're supposed to do works because of it. The whole idea is that you're made alive so that you can live. Luther actually uses this in his Galatians commentary, that justification is like God planting a tree. The whole idea is you plant the tree, God plants the tree, and then there's fruit that's born of it as a necessity. Rather than having this logical kind of wall that you have to jump over between the two, the whole thing is that God makes you alive so that you can live, and so that God's agency is preserved, but it also sets up this more cooperative aspect of the life lived. But even more importantly then is it connects what happens at final justification with initial justification. So those who are justified will be resurrected as well. They'll be made alive bodily in the same way that they were made alive inwardly by the Spirit now as well. And so that you see Paul use this the term zoe poiesis in both aspects, that you're made alive presently, but then also made alive by the agency of the Spirit in the future as well. And those two data points connect with one another. So it's that assurance of faith, as we might talk about, that if God has done this here, then it will be happen in the end as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts on why the distinct lexical choices there? Why justify it sometimes, and why, sanctification language? So I'm looking at that passage like 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 3, for this is the will of God, your sanctification. Is there a large, is this also just helpfully understood within the covenantal context, or how do you situate the sanctification language within your own project?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I don't spend a lot of time there. Romans 6 is where I would go to see a little bit more of this tied at least with the connection of justification.
Okay.
But importantly, two things I want to say there. It is a very interesting fact that Paul calls Christians saints, holy ones, over and over again, and not the just ones over and over again. And so if we think justification is the bedrock and then sanctification is kind of this
interesting,
very helpful, but sometimes variable, or it's actually the fact that they're holy ones is more identification with their identity. The other thing, too, I would say in Romans, a lot of times we get this idea that justification is what Romans 1 to 4 is about, and then sanctification is what 5 to 8 or 6 to 8 is about. And I think that fundamentally gets Paul's argument wrong there.
Okay.
In that sense, that the focus of 1 to 4 is justification by faith. So the question of how does faith lead into justification is his primary question in 1 to 4. But his argument in 5 to 8 is that justification entails being made alive.
Okay.
And so Romans, of course, 5:12-21 is all about dying in Adam, right? But then we're justified in Christ.
Yeah.
And what happened to Adam, it's not so much guilt that he focuses on in that passage, it's that Adam died.
Right, mortality spread.
And so through Adam, death came, and through Christ, life came. Or he also says, through Adam, condemnation came, and so through Christ, justification came. And so the whole thing is that the focus is not the verdict of condemnation or the verdict of justification, but it's execution in death or life.
In bringing death or life. Okay, yeah. That's helpful, yeah.
And importantly, he builds this whole argument off of Romans 4 when he says that Jesus' own resurrection is his vindication, his justification. And so Jesus wasn't declared righteous.
Right.
He was vindicated. He was raised. He was made alive.
Right.
As his justification. And so what I'm saying is that we just participate in Jesus. If it's good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for us.
Right, that's always the way to win the argument in the YouTube comments. Well, that's good too, because it ties us back to the beginning of our conversation where you said this is about participating in the glory of God, or that's your book title, but or participating in the righteousness of God, and you connected that with glory. And that's so he in Romans 3, he talks about, Christ having been raised from the dead, Romans 3 and 4, Christ's resurrection. And then in 6, he says it's the glory of the Father that raised Christ from the dead, right? Yep. So there you've got, again, the connection between the activity of God's glory or something like that, and it's in the fact that it brings immortality or resurrection or something like that. That's that's helpful. Okay, good. Anything else we should talk about?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's there's plenty more there. So an interesting passage to think about is 2 Corinthians 3, for instance.
Okay.
I'll be an endnote here. This is where the penny kind of dropped for me.
Okay.
Is that speaking of glory being made alive, actually Augustine in his treatise on the Spirit and the letter in the Spirit is the closest thing we get to an exposition of the doctrine of justification for him.
Okay.
And he doesn't go to Galatians, he doesn't go to Romans, he goes to 2 Corinthians 3.
Interesting, yeah.
The letter kills and the Spirit gives life is what he sees as the ministry of condemnation and the ministry of righteousness or the ministry of justification. And so in that sense, the Spirit giving life is the ministry of justification. Like, that's what basically justification entails. And importantly there, in the same way that Romans 8, Galatians, I would say 3 and 4, speak to this idea of new covenant, blessing, here in 2 Corinthians 3, you can't miss the New Covenant text,
right?
Jeremiah and Ezekiel 36. And so in that sense, that Paul is both framing justification in terms of New Covenant restoration. He's framing it as an experience of the Spirit making you alive because you participate in the Messiah, and that it that is over against the problem of death.
Okay.
And so, again, it's pervasive across, I think, Paul's letters. We've just so foregrounded forgiveness and then other debates around what justification entails that we, I think, have missed some of the what interpreters have seen before, and so that you kind of get, as some will say, the text has been lost under the interpretation. Again, I don't want to deny some of the benefits of these.
Sure.
What I'm saying is that what has been foregrounded needs to be backgrounded, and that that life is the primary focus of what Paul's talking about in justification.
Because I mean, as we kind of, one of our opening questions was, you know, why another book on this topic? And it's because, I mean, as you've said, with the layers of, you know, centuries of interpretation, it's not even necessarily that something totally new is being said. It's that over time, stuff gets foregrounded that maybe oughtn't be, or some stuff that, you know, ought to be in the front and center, you know, isn't, or something. And so you're not, as you said, you're not, you know, denying the reality of, you know, forgiveness or a juridical model or anything, but simply saying that, like, look, Paul seems to connect resurrection or life or mortality, all these things, quite closely with his justification language, and it's important to make those connections in the way that he does, right?
And what I would say there is, I think that one of the innovations or recognitions in the Reformation is that there's specifically legal language here. Melanchthon and Calvin took it in such a way that it's a declaration over against the execution, but they were right to very much foreground, like, this is forensic language, as they say, or legal language. And a lot of times when people hear this transformative language or being made alive, they're like, well, this doesn't sound very judicial anymore. Mm-hmm, well, and it's like, it is absolutely judicial if you understand the covenant lawsuit out of which it arises.
Yep, yep.
And so it's in no way a denial of even that, I think, important aspect. That you just have to understand what kind of lawsuit this is.
Exactly.
Who's the judge? Context is he making this judgment in?
And it's not a small claims court.
And so in that sense, that just like Moses said, I set before you blessing and cursing, life and death, choose life, you know. And so in that sense, like, well, they can't because they have the sin problem.
Okay.
Right? They need their heart circumcised. And so, as Paul says, the Spirit is the one who does that.
Yep.
And so this is leads us into this life of covenant blessing through Christ. And that's, you know, for those who are in Christ, he's set us free from the law of sin and death, or the law of the Spirit of life has set you free from the law of sin and death.
Yeah. Good. Ben, thanks so much for talking. This was really helpful. This was really good. This gives us, of course, lots to think about and also lots to look forward to. Your forthcoming book, it's Participating in the Righteousness of God. When's it going to be out, you think? Estimate?
Yes, God willing, 2024, probably the fall SBL time. So.
Okay, with Erdman's, right?
Yes.
Great. Okay, well, y'all can look for that. Thanks for joining us. My name, again, is Paul Sloan. I've been talking with Ben Blackwell. We teach here at Houston Christian University. And so if you want to find out more information about us, you can look us up. School of Christian Thought is the name of our school within Houston Christian University, and our seminary as well, Houston Theological Seminary. There's lots to look up there. We've got information about classes and anything else, and you can find other podcasts and related material if you're interested in this sort of thing. Thanks for watching. Thanks, Ben.
Yeah, thanks for having me.